From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Wherever you stand, it's easy to agree that Donald Trump is anything but a usual president. Next Sunday marks 2 years since Trump's inauguration, and so the reporters and editors at The Atlantic have put together a special report that tries to take stock of this presidency with a cool head and clear eyes. This hour on Point, 50 extraordinary moments in an extraordinary presidency. And you can join us. Can you list the ways President Trump has led this country that you think are norm-breaking, off-the-charts different, whether you think it's good or bad? And when the president's days in the White House inevitably come to an end, whether it's this term or perhaps the next, where will we be as a country? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Adrienne LaFrance. She's editor of theatlantic.com, and she conceived and co-edited this series. It's entitled Unthinkable, 50 Moments That Define an Improbable Presidency. It's just out this morning. We've linked to it at onpointradio.org. Adrienne, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with Adrienne in Washington are Yara Bayoumi, national security editor at The Atlantic. Yara, it's good to have you.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And McKay Coppin, staff writer for TheAtlantic.com. McKay, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Adrienne, let me just first start with you. President Trump's tenure in the White House thus far has, of course, been extraordinary. What was it about framing it this way with 50 moments that you felt would be compelling and help us understand the presidency even more?
When we started talking about the two-year mark, we were trying to think of ways to sort of contextualize for people and step out of sort of the chaos of this punishing daily news cycle. And in doing that, realized that there were so many things that felt truly consequential, that are truly consequential, that we'd forgotten about, frankly, or just sort of like had this reaction of, oh, yeah, that happened. Because there's so much that has happened, and the news cycle is so fast and so sort of rich, that we wanted to give people a chance to just sort of scan some of the highlights of the past 2 years and understand the consequence of them.
Right. And so, I mean, when you collate these 50 moments here, are there they definitely range far and wide across different things and approaches that President Trump has had here. But is there a sort of a major theme or pattern that emerges?
I think the pattern is sort of within the framing, which is this shattering of norms. Yeah. And so we see that happening across all different kinds of behaviors, both in how he communicates with the press and sort of just the way that he sees institutions. I mean, that's a major one, just a disregard for institutional norms. And it happens in sort of small ways and then very big ways. And so I think day to day, it can be hard to attach a weight to whatever it is that has happened. But looking back over two years, I mean, we had a research team comb through every single day of the first 2 years of the presidency. And we had at first hundreds of moments that mm-hmm. we wanted to parse down from. And we wound up with 50.
Right. You know, and of course, though, I have to say that the risk of doing this at any point in the presidency of Donald Trump is that something's going to happen before
we updated. We updated the editor's note like moments before publishing.
Well, because, for example, just this in the past couple of days, we had these two enormous reports, one from the New York Times, one from the Washington Post, about the New York Times reporting that the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation into the president in 2017 because the FBI was so worried about the president's actions. I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This isn't one of your 50 moments because this just happened, but Fox host Jeanine Pirro had President Trump on her show on Saturday, and she asked him about the New York Times report about this FBI counterintelligence investigation, and here's the exchange.
The investigation was whether you were actively working for Russia or unwittingly. So I'm going to ask you, are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing.
That was President Trump on Fox News on Saturday. And you note that in that cut, he didn't necessarily deny the charges. But I should say specifically this morning, President Trump absolutely specifically denied the charges that he was wittingly or unwittingly working with the Russians. I mean, Yara Bayoumi, you're the national security editor for The Atlantic. I'll get to what you wrote in the 50 Moments series in just a second. But give me your reaction to the news that unfolded this weekend.
I mean, you know, it's pretty incredible that we've seen that. And I think what it is that it's just the sort of beginning of what we are more likely to see in terms of more sort of revelations that may come out. Mostly because, you know, that with the Democrats in the House, we are going to see a much bigger elevation of a bunch of investigations that will happen. And they have a lot of questions about the last 2 years, and in particular, this big question of the Trump-Russia relationship there. There are many questions to parse, many questions for which they want answers. And I'm sure that we will therefore see that there, I mean, even though this weekend has been pretty incredible with those revelations that we've seen, there will be probably many, many more to come. And then the question there is going to be, where is the red line, and where do we get to the point where there are definitive answers?
Right. So I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there, and about where is the red line. And McKay Coppins, right. Let me just turn to you on that for a second, because in any other universe prior to 2016, 2017, the notion that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation on the president, or as the Washington Post reported, that the president has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal notes from his meetings with Vladimir Putin. I mean, these are things that would have brought Washington and the nation to a standstill. And yet, I don't want to say it's a blip, because it's not a blip. These things are big, but it's so much to process. I think people just kind of, we've lost a sense of how to measure what extraordinary is anymore.
Well, this is part of why I think this package is so remarkable, is that there's this corrosive effect that all these unprecedented, unthinkable moments piling on top of each other has on our politics, right? We have here in Washington a situation where the president's party has become so desensitized to all these major bombshells that are coming out in the news, the Russia investigation, and at least so far, for the most part, there's, you know, been this kind of partisan linking of arms surrounding the White House to defend him against every accusation. And yeah, you're right that in another era, at another time, in another presidency, these kinds of reports would derail a presidency. But we've now had 2 years of reports like this. Everyone in Washington has become desensitized to them. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of us in the country at large have. And the effect is that we don't have the same kind of political consequences that we probably would have in another period of time.
So, Adrian, let me ask you, as you were leading your team through this exercise of looking at every day of the Trump presidency so far, did you get the sense that this desensitization or the norm breaking is permanent in American politics, or can, I don't want to say necessarily can we go back to what it was before, but can the country regain a sense that there are uncrossable lines in how we comport ourselves politically?
It's such an important question. And I'll start just by sharing a brief anecdote, which is I was in the newsroom Friday night working on finalizing this package. And one of my colleagues came into my office and said that this New York Times push alert had just gone out for the story about the FBI inquiry. And this person was sort of like, yeah, I don't know if this is that big of a deal, because like, it makes sense that this would have happened. And I was sort of like, all right, let me read the headline aloud to you, which is FBI opened inquiry into whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russia. And just like letting that sink in. I mean, this is an extraordinary time, and the news is working in the news and experiencing the news as a news consumer is different than in any other presidency. And so to your question about whether the effects of this sort of norm shattering moment are permanent, I think some of them certainly will be, or at least will be very long lasting. And I think for people who are beginning to think about 2020, either as journalists or consumers of news, just knowing that whether or not Trump wins, the conditions that led to his election will be something that our country will have to continue to grapple with and try to understand going forward for a very long time.
Right. And Yara, just your take on that?
Again, I do think that when you sort of, if you take a moment just to look at where we are today, and see that at the end of the day, there isn't really very much news that we have seen that really is capable of surviving one Twitter cycle or even 24 hours. And that is just, I mean, and that by itself just shows you sort of the evolution of how we've gone from sort of the beginning of the Trump presidency to right now. And if the next two, you know, and if these 2 years were any indication, the next 2 years are going to probably be even more norm shattering than the last two have been.
Yeah. You know, so McKay, we got about a minute here before the break. And when we come back, we're going to talk in detail about some of the aspects of or parts of the list of 50 unthinkable moments here. But I wonder, I mean, we can talk about the effect this has on normative rules in American politics. But what about the country as a whole? I mean, I'm not quite sure I'm getting at here, but I think we're all affected by this somehow. Yeah. Well, you know, no matter if you follow obsessively everything that's happening in Washington or not.
Well, you know, I still think of a line from a cover story that we had at The Atlantic at the beginning of Trump's presidency, written by my colleague David Frum. And he kind of wrote this. The opening scene was predicting what it would be like 4 years later. And one of the things that he said was that a large portion of Americans would become so desensitized and burned out on the constant flow of news and controversy and debate that they would simply check out of the news. And that's the thing that I fear as I'm reading through these. We forget about so many of these things, but we also, I think a lot of the people I know are just choosing to check out because it's so stressful.
Yeah. Well, McKay Coppins, Yara Bayoumi, and Adrian LaFrance, stand by here. We're talking about The Atlantic's list of 50 unthinkable moments that have defined President Trump's presidency thus far. We've got a link to their online presentation. It's quite extensive at onpointradio.org. And we want to know what you think. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about The Atlantic's new feature entitled 50 Unthinkable Moments, or Unthinkable, I should say, 50 moments that have defined President Trump's tenure in the White House thus far. Adrian LaFrance joins us. She's editor of TheAtlantic.com. She developed and co-edited this series. Yara Bayoumi is with us as well. She's national security editor for TheAtlantic.com. And McKay Coppins is with us, staff writer for TheAtlantic.com. Adrian, I want to actually just go to a moment or an aspect of the presidency that you've written about for this series, and that is the president on social media. So first of all, here is a moment in October of 2017 in an interview with Fox's Maria Bartiromo. She asked the president about his Twitter habit and whether or not he thought it got in the way of his policies. And here's what he said.
I have friends that say, oh, don't use social media. See, I don't call it tweets. Tweeting is like a typewriter. When I put it out, you put it immediately on your show. I mean, the other day I put something out. 2 seconds later, I'm watching your show. It's up.
Donald You're right. Trump is, We're watching okay. your Twitter feed.
Okay. And you know, they're well-crafted. I was always a good student. I'm like a person that does well with that kind of thing. And I doubt I'd be here if it weren't for social media, to be honest with you.
That's President Trump with Fox's Maria Bartiromo. And I'm sorry I said her name incorrectly before that piece of tape. Adrian, you wrote about this in a piece titled 6 hours and 3 minutes of Internet Chaos, Covfefe. So why did that make the list?
I think the president's use of Twitter is fascinating to me. And I think is actually a really big part of the desensitization that we've been talking about. At the same time, I think it's a clear demonstration of what is Donald Trump's true gift. I mean, his genius actually is getting people to pay attention to him. And as we heard in the clip just now, he recognizes that he tweets it goes directly onto cable TV. It goes directly into newspapers and magazines online. And so I think that he just has this preternatural ability to have all eyes on him, and Twitter is obviously a huge part of that in his presidency. Covfefe, I'm not actually sure how to pronounce
it. Neither am I,
but we'll go with that. So for those who don't remember the moment, this was on May 31st, 2017, May 31st, 2017, just after midnight, and the president tweeted, despite the constant negative press covfefe, that's spelled C-O-V-F-E-F-E, and then stopped. That was it. And so there was this furious overnight speculation about what that meant, what happened, why didn't he follow up? And he has never explained it. So it remains a very strange, you know, in the annals of Trump tweets, it's up there for me.
Well, but it also shows, I mean, as he said in that Fox News clip we heard, he said he wouldn't be here if it weren't for social media. He knows how to use this medium. And quite frankly, we in the media and maybe the country as a whole, we play along. I mean, playing along maybe isn't the right word, but we allow ourselves to be led by what he's saying on Twitter.
That's right. And this is part of the norm shattering aspect of the presidency. You know, when the president of the United States does something or says something that's so far outside of the bounds of what is accepted or considered appropriate, reporters instantly see that as newsworthy. And often it is. But I think if you talk to, I'm sure this happens at WBUR as well, any newsroom right now is grappling with how do we cover the tweets, including ours. And so it remains a live question of properly documenting the presidency and holding him accountable, but also knowing which ones are consequential and in what ways in the moment.
Right. Well, Yara, this brings us to what you wrote about, right? Because I think that as the months and the almost 2 years have progressed, I think the consensus is we have to cover the tweets, right? Because as you wrote, a name-calling feud ended with the Secretary of State's ouster by tweet.
Right, exactly. And I think what we were looking for here was to show sort of the bigger picture of how the U.S. has really kind of lost a lot of its standing in the world by the Trump administration's shunning of what used to be sort of traditional U.S. diplomacy that we saw. And that was sort of encapsulated in how Trump fired his top diplomat in chief at the time, Rex Tillerson, which was by tweet. And so kind of taking on from that, I think, is this really important aspect that I have been following sort of in the national security realm for the last 2 years, and which I thought was very important to talk about over here, which is looking at all of the ways in which the U.S. has in every sort of diplomatic aspect, whether it is in terms of siding with its allies or in sort of where the U.S. stands on international treaties and where the U.S. stands even in more in taking specific and on-point issues and issues of moral standing, has really degraded in part because of, or in large part because of, where we've seen Trump stand on those issues.
Well, let's go to a call here because we've got a lot of them on the line here. So Peter is calling from Oneida, New York. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the biggest deviation from the norm with respect to the Trump presidency has been the refusal by large parts of the political establishment and the media establishment to accept the fact that Donald Trump won the election. Instantly, when it looked like he was going to win, there was immediate discussion, immediate comments that I believe were intended to delegitimize that election. And how was it possible that Hillary Clinton lost the election? It must have been due to Russian interference. We've had 2 years of talk about Russia or wolf, and no wolf has showed up. So, yes, I think the American people have been desensitized to some of this stuff. But I'd like to ask your panel, I'd like to ask you, do you accept that Donald Trump won the election.
Well, Peter, thank you for your call. I'll go to McKay Coppins first. McKay, go for it.
I do accept that Donald Trump won the election, if that's the direct question. I think to his more broader question, I understand that frustration, and I actually hear it from a lot of President Trump supporters when I go to his rallies, when I am talking to Republicans here in Washington. They will often say, you know, there's this Trump derangement syndrome that's overtaken the media and the Democrats and makes it so that everything that he does is portrayed negatively and nobody gives any context to anything he says or does. I think that that's a half fair critique. I do think that there is some of that. But I also think that the people making that argument often downplay the degree to which President Trump is genuinely doing unprecedented things. That, I mean, the fact that we could create this package and go through this list, that we had to dramatically pare down, you know, hundreds of examples to get to these 50, you know, I guess I would ask the caller and just generally people who make this argument to go through this list of 50 things and these unthinkable moments, as we describe them, and tell us which of these is getting too much attention, which of these is acceptable or normal behavior from a president. Because I do think that while the Trump derangement syndrome question is real, there's also a huge normalizing effect that this president has had in kind of creating this accommodationist attitude toward behavior that we never would have accepted or seen as normal in another president.
Hmm. And since Peter asked the question directly of me, too, I should say that I do, of course, accept that Donald Trump was legitimately elected as president of the United States, but that also at the same time, in the investigations that are underway about what influence Russia may have had need to be allowed to come to their formal completion. I mean, that's actually good for democracy as a whole. We ought to know exactly what forces were at play in the 2016 election here. But let's go to another caller. Kate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My concern is that the standards that we have in the country are totally being ignored for this man. He bragged about sexually abusing women and he got elected. His method of dealing with political diplomacy is to say, I fell in love with a dictator and Putin didn't interfere because he said so. And that is so blatantly immature. And to make statements like that, and I cannot fathom that this individual is leading the country. And frankly, I don't say leading. I think he's simply abusing. And he puts people in ahead of the EPA that worked for the coal industry and therefore have no incentive to protect. Their whole job prior was to, you know, mm-hmm. utilize our resources. I'm just very concerned that there will be any country left.
Well, Kate, thank you for your call. Adrienne LaFrance, would you like to respond to Kate?
Yes, I think, Kate, you've touched on something that emerged in a pattern in our series as well, which is you mentioned the EPA, and we've seen in many agencies just this sort of rejection of expertise and sort of either a disregard or even antagonism for evidence-based thinking. We have at least many of our essays touch on this, but three in particular, Sarah Zhang's, Ed Yong's, and Tom Nichols, all write on variations of this theme, and it is one of the things that was really pronounced in our research of the first 2 years of the presidency.
Yara, was that you?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in there just to say as well that, you know, the flip side of this is that, you know, this is not operating in a vacuum, and there has also been an evolution in how the reaction to Trump as well in these moments, right? And particularly in these issues of national security, Kate, in which you also brought up. When we look at the beginning of this of the presidency, a lot of the pronouncements, audacious pronouncements that were made, sort of held allies were usually quite stunned, unable to know what to make of it, and sort of scrambling to try and figure out, you know, how to deal with the fallout. Whereas when you look at where we are today, you see that they are much more proactive because of what they see as what is damage that the U.S. is embarking on. I mean, a really great example of that, which was also an essay that we wrote about, was how world leaders reacted to Trump at the United Nations General Assembly address in September. They at that point were able to very comfortably laugh at the president after he made this pronouncement that his administration had accomplished nearly more than any other administration had previously. We also see that European allies now are very much taking into their own hands how they can deal with issues of their national security, where they can no longer depend on the U.S. As they could before. So I think there is also an evolution here in sort of what the reaction is to that, and that to some extent might limit some of the fallout.
Well, in that case, I mean, the supporters of the president would say he's been very successful on that front, because in terms of the European allies taking more of their own national security into their own hands and not relying on the United States. That's what the president has been calling for.
That's true in some points, but I mean, if this is going to be the measure by which the Trump presidency measures its success, then you have to look at the next time that there is a major national security threat in which America will need its European allies, and how will European allies react in that sense when they can no longer count on the U.S. before. That is a major question that we may be tested on in the next coming years.
Yeah. Well, McKay Coppins, let me turn to you, because the caller also mentioned she led by saying by lamenting the president's bragging about assaulting women in that Access Hollywood tape before the election here. So the president's talking about how he approaches issues of regarding women and sexual assault is a big factor that we ought to talk about here, because it also came up in Professor Christine Blasey Ford and her accusations against now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And of course, she testified before Congress, as Kavanaugh did as well. And during a rally in South Haven, Mississippi in October, the president mocked Professor Ford's testimony before the Senate. Here's what the president did.
How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember.
It's President Trump in October. McKay Coppins, this was the moment that you wrote about for The Atlantic. Why?
Well, I think first it's important to remember the context here, right? This was in the midst of the confirmation battle over Brett Kavanaugh, which had really kind of consumed the country, right? It's hard for me to remember a more kind of polarizing, divisive moment in our politics in the last couple of years than this. You know, the temperature was running hot across the country. And normally in moments like this, the president's job is at the very least to kind of not dial up the rhetoric. But of course, that's what the president did. He showed up at this rally. And while Republicans on Capitol Hill had been trying to kind of tread lightly with Christine Blasey Ford and, you know, not attack her too deliberately, fearing a backlash, President Trump got up there in front of his crowd of roaring admirers and kind of couldn't help himself and launched into this kind of whole performance in which he was imitating Professor Ford and mocking her memory. And, you know, I have to say that this is kind of emblematic of the way that President Trump uses his rallies, right? Ever since he first launched his presidential bid, he was kind of distinguished by the carnival-like quality of his rallies, where he would give these stump speeches that were, you know, part insult comedy routine and part partisan tirade. And even as a candidate, people kind of instantly recognized this as something we hadn't seen before, at least not in modern presidential politics. Yeah. But the fact that he then entered office, ratcheted up the rhetoric, continued to do these rallies, and this one in particular struck me because it was kind of came in the midst of this cultural moment where we had the Me Too movement and we were having these conversations about sexual assault, about the things that women were suffering and at the hands of powerful men, and President Trump ignored that or actually used that cultural context to provoke and make his point in a way that really offended a lot of people.
Well, we are talking about The Atlantic's series Unthinkable, 50 Moments That Define an Improbable Presidency. You just heard McKay Coppins. Yara Bayoumi is also with us, and Adrienne LaFrance is as well. She's the editor of TheAtlantic.com who developed this series. We got a link to it at onpointradio.org, and when we come back, we'll take more of your thoughts about how norm-breaking this presidency has been thus far, whether it's a good or a bad thing for America. And when you see a list of 50 of the many moments of norm-breaking that President Trump has brought to American politics, what effect has that had on the country? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about The Atlantic's list of 50 moments that define an improbable presidency, as they say. The series, or the special reporting, is called Unthinkable, and it's linked at our website, onpointradio.org. Adrienne LaFrance joins us. She's the editor of TheAtlantic.com. She developed and co-edited this series. Yara Bayoumi is with us. She's national security editor for TheAtlantic.com. And McKay Coppins is with us as well, staff writer at TheAtlantic.com. And Adrienne, let me turn back to you here, because in the series, you rank the 50 moments that you chose. Admittedly, you say it's a very subjective ranking. But number one on that list is the family separation policy that the administration enacted in March of 2018. And before we discuss why you put that one as number one, I want to play a little bit of tape, because in March of 2017, then Department of Homeland Security Chief John Kelly spoke to CNN's Wolf Blitzer about the plans to implement child separation. And again, it was implemented a year later in March of 2018. And here's what Kelly said on CNN.
If you get some young kids who are coming in, managed to sneak into the United States with their parents, are Department of Homeland Security personnel going to separate the children from their moms and dads?
Yes, I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents.
That's John Kelly when he was the head of the Department of Homeland Security in 2017. So, Adrienne LaFrance, this was a huge issue in the presidency. And so you put it as number one. Tell us more.
So I think you could make the case that many of these, all within, say, the top five of our list, you know, numbers one through five, could be considered number one. And I guess I should talk a little bit about how we think about the ranking. So something about the series that was very important to us was making sure that the idea wasn't to make a value judgment about the presidency, but more to take a step back and really look at the consequences of these shattered norms. And so as we thought about how, you know, once we had our pile of 50 moments, as we thought about how to organize those, we wanted to really weight consequence and sort of gravity. And, you know, I think for family separation, just the moral aspect of it just very clearly made it seem like it was the most consequential norm shattering thing that we've encountered.
Well, so tell us more about that, because, I mean, I would agree. There are many other things on the list, and they're all significant moments, but some of them can be seen through purely the lens of politics, right? But the family separation policy, I think, was one that perhaps even for some of the president's most ardent supporters, because it did venture into this question of the moral comportment of the United States. And beforehand, you know, I think it was presumed that there was moral agreement that separating children from their parents was not something that, you know, a sophisticated, humane democracy does. And yet it happened, right? So this, I think it does make it slightly different or very different from many of the other startling moments of this presidency.
Right. And if I may read a line from Ashley Fetter's piece, she's the person who wrote this essay that I found to be really salient, is, "It is an axiom of moral life among civilized humans that to separate young children from their parents is an offense against not just nature, but society." And then she goes on to say, "Forcibly yanking children from their parents is of a piece with some of the darkest moments of American history, the internment of Japanese Americans, the forcible separation of American Indian children into special boarding schools, slavery." And so I think the interesting thing is that there are these historical echoes, and yet you pause and you say it's 2019, like, how can this be happening?
Mm. Well, McKay Coppins, though, on the flip side of that, the family separation policy was brought to an end through the institutions of the United States government here. So as we're talking about, I mean, through court order, right? So as we're talking about norm shattering, shouldn't we also be talking about the ways in which the established institutions of the United States are responding as well?
That's a good point. And I don't think that it was ever our intent with this package to forecast, you know, a complete abandonment of hope in, you know, American institutions. I do think that actually there's a case to be made that while the president is breaking norms left and right, and while there are elements of the political class and his own party who have rallied around him, the core institutions of American democracy have not been shattered. They have held up to a certain degree. And like you said, the courts have held this president in check in a way that Congress has not up to now. But I do think that there's still this kind of important effect that will have long-term consequences. Even just in this case, for example, Ashley Fetters, who wrote this piece, points out that the Republican Party, the party of Donald Trump, for decades has made it a core plank of their platform, a core element of their message, that the family is a building block of society, is the core building block of society. This was the kind of intellectual backbone of social conservatism for a long time. And now to have a president who very deliberately, an administration very deliberately separate families as a matter of policy, and then to have the vast majority of elected Republican officials either stay silent or back up the president on that policy feels like a tectonic shift in Republican politics that will have ripple effects for years to come.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to our callers here. John is calling from Chicago. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think I've got about 30 years experience, over 30 years experience in state and federal government. And I think one point that you guys might be missing is the fact that before Trump came, government was totally dysfunctional. And Trump, I'm an independent voter, and my perspective on Trump is he's a catalyst for change. It's not about what he's doing and how he's saying it. He's a catalyst for change. He's forcing both sides to address issues that they haven't been willing to address for years and years.
Yeah.
And I think talking about, you know, all of his personal stuff, what it does is it keeps people from talking about the subjects that he's raising. And one of the last thing I just want to point out is one thing you're missing with Trump is he likes agreements. If the Democrats and the Republicans came to Trump and said, okay, we're going to address the border, you know, the security along our border, we're going to address it, and this is how we think the right way to do it. There may be a combination of barriers and, drones and stuff like that, but if they came, both sides came to him and said, this makes sense, this is a economically feasible way, and it's a way we're going to address this issue. It's been, you know, we've been talking about it for decades. It's going to be addressed. Trump would agree to it.
Well, but John, if can I just jump here for a second? Because I have a quick question for you, or two questions actually. One is, that is what happened last year. There was agreement on dealing with, for example, the border wall and DACA recipients as well, and the president backed away from that. He deep sixed that agreement. So
that's not correct. There was a partial fix, but it wasn't 100% fix. That's not correct. And see, that's the problem with when
but what do you mean by, if I may say, what do you mean by 100% fix? You were talking about if Democrats and Republicans came together with agreement, the president would say okay.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying, I'm confused about if you're talking about 100 agreement between Democrats and Republicans or a 100% fix. And what do you mean by that?
The fix, well, the barrier and the border issue itself, it addressed part of the border issue, but didn't address 100% of what the total solution was going to be. It was a partial funding and basically kicked the can down the road a little bit further. And essentially, this isn't about Trump. This is about there's multiple issues going on: China, Russia, the border wall. There's a bunch of issues that have been on the minds of Americans for years and years and years. And it would just be nice, okay, this issue, forget about, take Trump out of the picture. Let's just address this issue, both sides.
Well,
that's not what we're hearing.
John, sorry, I just want to take it back from you because I want to get our panel a chance to respond to what you're saying. And thank you so much for your call. Yara Bayoumi, let me turn to you here. I mean, to John's original point about he sees the president as a catalyst for change to confront the dysfunction that he believes has been going on in American government for years. What do you say to that first?
I mean, there is no doubt that a lot of what Donald Trump has been doing for the last 2 years has shaken up the very foundations of what has been traditionally decades of U.S. positions, U.S. standing, U.S. points of view on a variety of different issues, whether it's in sort of the national security realm or in the domestic or in the domestic realm. But at the same time, it is very hard to ignore what the president is using as justification to propel this change. And in many cases, we see that there are a lot of untruths and lies to back up and to make the case for the change that this administration is trying to pursue. So it's very difficult to separate, really, this idea that it's a catalyst for change while also ignoring that sometimes the underlying facts, quote unquote, used to propel that are not accurate, and that is to the detriment for the American public.
Right, and you know, the question is what kind of change is being catalyzed here? And I think that's one of the things that I come back to over and over again as I look through this list of these 50 moments. So what are the consequences? What are the consequences of the speed and the kind of change that the president has been bringing to this country? Let's go to David, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna panel. I think that the darkest transformation under Trump has been sort of the complete abandonment of biblical morality among evangelicals. And they are so fixated on conservative judges to overturn Roe v. Wade that they somehow justify child separation, family separation, absurd realities that are so anti-biblical principle. I mean, and they support Trump no matter what. And I think, you know, just on the very basis of by their fruits will you know them, Trump's fruits are racist, hideous policy.
Well, David, can I just jump in for a second? So sorry to interrupt, but I think you told our screener that are you seeing this in your own family? I mean, do you have a life experience in?
Oh, yes, I grew up on the mission field in Haiti. My sister and brother went back to the mission field. My niece married a national and served there now. And I watched my father serve the poor for all these years. And now my sister and my dad are both going, build that wall. And I'm like, who are you people? Who are you? And it's the sad thing is, in favor of protecting a fetus, once the child's born, they're just a liability. They're just problematic. Mm. And that's insane as far as ethics and Christian morality goes, in my view.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call. Adrian, what do you think?
I think this is something we've heard a lot throughout the Trump presidency. And in fact, there is another cover story that The Atlantic published in August by Michael Gerson that digs really deeply into this theme, sort of making the argument that evangelicals were once this culturally confident contingency that became anxious and just seeking political protection, and that they're doing so at a time when we have the least traditionally religious president in living memory. And so I think that the thing he's hitting on is certainly a huge part of the conversation about this presidency.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get one more caller in here if we can. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. No, he's not, actually. He's just dropped in the line there. Sorry about that. Michael's just about to go to you. So, okay, let's go to Cindy, who's calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. No, I do not believe that there's anything normal about this Trump presidency. I think that every American, if they stop and really think deeply, do they trust this man? Do you go to sleep at night trusting this man that he will make the right decisions for us? I do not think so. The shutdown is obvious proof because he says he wants to protect us, and yet he's putting us in harm's way by certain departments within our government are not being employees are not there. Mm-hmm. And this is a ripe opportunity for something to happen. And something critical, and then that would make him, I'm concerned because he's irrational, he's not stable, and I'm concerned that he would make some stupid judgment, like calling martial law.
Well, Cindy, I'm going to take it back from there because we just got a couple of minutes left here, but thank you so much for your call. Adrian, Yara, and McKay, we have 2 minutes left here to go. I'm wondering, last question for all of you. As you did the work of going through each and every day of the Trump administration and sort of taking all of these extraordinary moments and trying to whittle it down to 50, I'm wondering if there's anything sort of any new insight or any new takeaway that you had from these last 2 years that we have as a nation have collectively experienced. And Adrian, let me start with you since you edited this series.
I think the big takeaway, especially the finished product we have here, is just the sort of the magnitude of what our country is experiencing sort of washes over you as you peruse the list and then as you read these beautiful essays. And I think there's also sort of a contradiction here because many of the moments that seemed really shocking at the time didn't, make our cut not because they weren't shocking, but because they didn't feel consequential. And so I think we're still very much, put it this way, the pressing question that I find myself asking probably on a daily basis, just to try to contextualize this moment in political and American history is how does this end? And I think that looking at this list gives us hints, but we won't know until it does. And there was clarity in this process, but so many questions remain.
Right. Well, you know what? Since we're out of time here, and Adrian, since you edited that series, I'm going to let you have the last thought for today. But Adrian LaFrance, editor of TheAtlantic.com, she developed and co-edited this series called Unthinkable, 50 Moments That Define an Improbable Presidency. Adrian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Yara Bayoumi, national security editor at TheAtlantic.com. It was a great pleasure to speak with you, Yara. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And McKay Coppins, staff writer at TheAtlantic.com. McKay, it's always great to have you on the show. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And folks, go to onpointradio.org where you can find a link to The Atlantic's series. And also, you can subscribe to our newsletter right on our homepage. Again, that's onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.